From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Alex Berenson is joining us to make his case against marijuana. And he knows he's fighting against the current these days. Recreational pot is legal in 9 states. In 33 states, marijuana is allowed to be used as medicine. But Berenson says marijuana is not medicine, and it's not the panacea some think it is. His most serious charge is that cannabis can aggravate or cause psychosis and lead to violence. His book is called Tell Your Children.
My name is Daisha Eaton. I am a reporter covering religion and social justice for KUER. I became interested in public radio because I realized in listening how powerful it is to hear someone else's story through their voice. It is beyond anything you can do through the written word.
Help KUER bring the stories that matter to your state. Make a contribution today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Alex Berenson expected a wave of criticism as he wrote his book challenging the arguments of pro-marijuana advocates. And to be sure, he's gotten it. They've raised a number of questions, some of which we'll get to, about whether he's misinterpreted or cherry-picked data and statistics, that he's biased or alarmist. But Berenson is holding his own, making a case against the idea that marijuana is some kind of natural panacea to any number of problems. And he always gets asked whether he thinks marijuana should be legalized. We'll get to that question, too. But he says the legal status of pot is less important to him than people understanding what he says are the risks. Most people who smoke cigarettes, he says, will not die of lung cancer. But we know enough to say cigarettes cause cancer, so we should say so. And in the same way, he says most people who smoke marijuana will, of course, not develop psychosis or not commit violence. But in his book, he does make that connection. The book is called Tell Your Children, The Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. Alex Berenson is a former reporter for The New York Times, and he joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. I wanted to begin with how you came to the story and ask you, before you started researching cannabis, what were your own impressions about marijuana? I mean, you mentioned in the book you smoked pot a few times when you were younger, and you had, as you put it, no moral problem with it. So how did you even what were you even thinking about marijuana in the early days?
I mean, you know, honestly, I wasn't thinking about it that much. And in that, I think I'm like most Americans, you know, who don't necessarily have a particularly strong view on either medical or recreational cannabis either way, even if they have smoked a few times. You know, I live in New York State, which although now is talking about legalized cannabis, you know, a few years ago, that really wasn't something that was being discussed. And, you know, yes, there was a medical program, but it certainly didn't – there were no dispensaries or very few. It wasn't really part of my life, and I didn't really think that much about it.
So what's the impression, do you think, that you've encountered? What are you hearing mostly now that you think you're trying to counter, that it's natural, that this is for people who are looking for a state of euphoria, that so it's a responsible way to go? I mean, what's the general impression that you encounter, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think the general impression of cannabis, and I think the, you know, I think the idea that cannabis is linked to mental illness or violence is very much not in the culture.
Yeah.
And to the extent that it is, it's a joke to people, you know, that they do think reefer madness. You know, reefer madness has become shorthand for you know, a whole bunch of over-the-top government propaganda about drugs, which basically, by the way, we don't see that much of anymore. You know, the government, you know, NIDA and other government agencies' discussions of drugs are far more balanced, or, you know, are far more carefully, I would say, and scientifically crafted than they used to be. But so you know, I think the cultural impression of cannabis is, for the most part, certainly on the coast, but, you know, but really everywhere to a greater or lesser extent, yes, it's natural. It's a plant. It's definitely safer for you than alcohol. The only reason that it's illegal is because there was this crazy racism and these lies told about it, you know, 50 and 75 years ago. And so a bunch of people who didn't know anything about science decided to make it illegal. All stoners do is sit on their couches and eat Doritos. And if to the extent that there are problems with cannabis, it's because cannabis is illegal and a lot of Black and Hispanic people get arrested and they get sent to prison for many years and their lives are ruined because of this. And yes, that can happen to white people, but mainly it doesn't. And that cannabis is medicine, that cannabis has a lot of medicinal purposes, that it might be really good for treating PTSD, that it might be really good for treating pain, that it hasn't been very well researched, but that when we research it, we're going to find all this wonderful stuff out about it. And to be honest, as I researched the book, I realized that basically everything that I've just said to you is untrue. Oh, one more myth that has spread in the last 5 to 10 years as the opioid epidemic has taken off is that cannabis might be a solution for the opioid epidemic. That really there's untold possibility with this drug that we really are being kept from by bad government policy. And it turns out that basically all of that is untrue.
We're going to get into at least some of that you mentioned, of course. I do think the title of the book is interesting. Tell Your Children. Some may not know it was actually the original title of the film Reefer Madness. So by picking that, is it you trying to be kind of ironic, or are you in some ways sort of reclaiming a sense of legitimate alarm that has come to be widely mocked now in the culture?
Can I say both? Because it's both. And, yeah. and there's a third point, which is I want people to tell their children, because there are a lot of parents out there, especially in the last couple of years with the rise of Juul and vaping. There's a bulge now in teen use of nicotine and in young adult use of nicotine, and cannabis. And I do think we don't have data yet for the last year or two, but I suspect there's strong growth in teen use of cannabis too. And these high THC products are, they are dangerous to a lot of kids. They're dangerous. Statistically, there's no question that there are going to be kids they're going to break. Psychiatrically break. And so there are going to be parents who are seeing their kids use and seeing problems with their kids and have really no idea how to talk to them about this and to talk to the kids about risks. And that's, the book is also about that. The book has been pigeonholed, unfortunately, from my point of view, as a book about legalization. I barely discuss legalization. Yeah. This is a book about health and science.
Yeah. I actually want to ask about the distinction there. There's this let me get to this first, because we may get back to this, but I'm interested in how you're describing the reaction to the book right now, because it certainly challenges, obviously, some conventional thinking that we talked about through a lot of people for a loop, I think. And the book comes at a time when, of course, this national trend, as you mentioned, is very much going toward mainstream marijuana use in some ways, recreationally, medically even. So how do you describe the strong reaction that you've gotten? Surely you expected it, of course.
I expected it on some level. So there's the user reaction, and you can just see that on Twitter. I mean, there's a lot of people who've told me they're not quite death threats. They're sort of more death wishes. I hope a drunk driver hits you. And the one thing I really don't like is when people say, I want to get your kids high. My kids are 6 and 3, so that's not really very funny to me. Yeah. But users, they strongly dislike this idea that this might be something other than medicine, that this might be a dangerous recreational intoxicant. What is very disappointing to me is that the advocacy community has tried to shout down the book rather than engage with the science. Because you can believe, you can say, this stuff, we don't want to talk about it very much, but it's a real risk. And we're going to talk to people about how to warn, teens and young adults and adults about these risks. But we still believe this drug should be legal. There's lots of good reasons to make this drug legal. And alcohol and tobacco, which have known harms, are legal. So let's talk about these risks, but let's talk about it in the context of legalization. That is not how places like the Drug Policy Alliance have reacted. They have tried to shout me down. They've said that the book science is wrong without saying what parts of it are wrong, because there are basically no factual inaccuracies in the book. I think somebody pointed to one sentence that was wrong. And they've said, well, there are no footnotes in the book, which unfortunately is true. And that may be something I may correct for the paperback. But no one has said, these studies are not real or that I'm misrepresenting them or anything like that. So I've been very disappointed in the legalization slash reform, you know, the self-styled reform community's response to this. And frankly, I've been kind of disappointed in the media's response. I feel like I have some reasonably good journalistic credentials here. I was a reporter for, you know, more than 15 years. I was a reporter for the New York Times for 10 years. I wrote a ton of investigative stuff, mainly about pharma. And so to see that places like the Washington Post or the LA Times, you know, barely talk about, the LA Times never mentioned the book. The Washington Post said it was alarmist and nothing else. In an aside, National NPR has not had me on. I'm very glad to come on with you. I'm glad to come on with whatever NPR will have me on. And I expect that you're going to ask me tough questions about this. But the idea that there's been, you know, to some extent, a partial media blackout on the center left about this is really surprising to me.
We'll get into the details in a moment. But part of the negative reaction to the book has been the science that not the science that you necessarily cite, but the way you've interpreted it. And we'll sort of dig into that in a minute. It did raise a question for me about the way you see your role. You mentioned that you have been a journalist for a number of years, worked for the New York Times, covered, as you've talked about before, pretty aggressively big pharma. But do you see yourself now as a dispassionate, objective reporter, or do you think this is something else? Because you confess early on in the book, in the introduction, that the book is not, in fact, balanced. How do you see your role in writing the book?
So I see my role as presenting facts accurately. I don't, as I say in the book, and as you just quoted, I don't say the book is balanced. You know, there are certainly going to be some positives from marijuana legalization. Although in the states that have legalized, those are pretty thin on the ground, but there are at least some theoretical positives. And to the extent people just want to use a recreational intoxicant that, you know, isn't going to harm their livers, you know, that's a reason to use marijuana. But I don't see my role as saying, you know, here's three chapters about the psychosis stuff that you've never heard about. And now here's three more about, you know, recounting what Sanjay Gupta said about, you know, CBD for epilepsy. You've heard all of that before, and I don't need to tell you that. And by the way, I don't view this book as a left-right book. I view it as a medical and science book. But I have to say, I am more comfortable being an advocate for my book than I think I would have been 10 or 15 years ago, because I think that's where journalism has gone.
You write in the book, "I'm old enough to understand how difficult a task I've set myself with this book." What does that mean? What's the task? Changing people's minds, yes?
Yes, meaning you need to understand the real risks here, and you need to see those.
I wanted to ask you, why do most people smoke pot? Most people, why do you think they smoke pot?
Well, you know, based on my friends and my very limited experience and what I hear from users, people smoke to get high. I mean, that's why the medicine thing is a real, it's a real red herring. And, you know, and most people who use cannabis under medical marijuana laws, were recreational users before. Why do people, I think I say, you know, at the very beginning of the book that the urge for intoxication and euphoria, you know, chemical intoxication and euphoria is part of what it is to be human.
Well, there's this argument that we heard a lot of during the debate in Utah last year over medical marijuana, that it's less about what you were talking about, less about recreational use, as it is about stripping out the stigma of marijuana to this reasonable level so you can make it accessible for people who need it for medical applications. You're pretty skeptical about that, and I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that, because you write this. You say the goal of a lot of these groups is, as you say, not marijuana decriminalization. It's legalization. And I think explaining the distinction here, Alex, is important too.
Sure. So decriminalization is a policy essentially where we're going to acknowledge that marijuana possession and use are effectively unenforceable. Okay. That they're, you know, they're not very serious crimes, and that 40 million people used cannabis in the United States in 2017. And we need to have sort of a category that doesn't involve you being arrested for that. So even though we don't want to encourage use, and even though we wanted, you know, trafficking of marijuana under this scheme is still going to be criminalized theoretically, although in reality that, you know, the police generally have other things to worry about besides marijuana trafficking. Yeah. And the sentences even for that are relatively light. But for explicit possession and use, you are not going to go to jail. You're not going to be arrested for this. If, you know, possibly you're going to get a ticket, you know, which is sort of going to be the equivalent of a parking ticket that you'll have to pay. But you're certainly not going to be wind up with a criminal record. And so all the negative consequences that legalization groups or nearly all the negative consequences that legalization groups talk about coming from arrests, you know, such as, you know, lack of access to public housing, let's say, or public benefits programs, those won't exist anymore. But at the same time, we're going to say this is, you know, we don't want to legalize this. We don't want an industry around this. Mm. And so we're not going to allow large scale sales to be legally permitted.
Right. There's a bit of a conventional wisdom you challenge early on in the book, the idea that, you know, scores and scores and scores of people are being imprisoned for possession of marijuana. You say that seems like you're saying that time has passed, actually, in this country.
Oh, yes. It passed many years ago. You know, there was certainly a period of time in the United States when you could go to jail for a long time for possessing joints. And there may be exceptionally rare cases right now where that happens. I don't want to say that never happens, but it almost never happens. And that's true even in the South, even in states that, you know, that lock a lot of people up and are quite conservative. Almost nobody is in prison for marijuana possession and use. Now, I'm not going to say people don't get arrested. And I'm not going to say that there aren't racial disparities in arrests, because there clearly are and people do. But when you're actually talking about facing real jail time, that's exceptionally rare.
I want to get to a couple of these issues, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on some of these because I want to get to the central theme in your book, which is about mental illness and violence and its relationship with cannabis. But say something, if you would, about a couple of things here. You mentioned in the book how more permissive attitudes about marijuana have driven up consumption. How much are we talking about in terms of more consumption, do you think?
So that's quite clear. And the data is really, you know, the U.S. and Canada, which have sort of this very aggressive legalization movement and a pretty noisy lobby of users. If you compare us to Britain, U.S. and Canada, that is, to Britain, in 2000 through 2005, cannabis use rates were roughly the same in all three countries. About 10% of adults had used in the last year. Now, in Britain, there's been a pretty aggressive effort by a group of psychiatrists there to highlight this cannabis psychosis mm-hmm. risk. And so use in Britain has actually fallen by about a third in the last 10 to 15 years since 2005. In the UK, I should say.
Yeah.
In the US and Canada, use has risen roughly 50%. So 15% of adults used in 2017. So use has now double in the US and Canada relative to the UK. And what's even more interesting is that use has risen even faster among really heavy users. So in the U.S., consumption among heavy users, which you define as people who are using every day, mm-hmm. essentially, it's called daily or near daily use in the federal surveys, has roughly tripled in the last 15 years. There were 3 million of those people in 2005. By 2017, which is the most recent year for which we have data, there were more than 8 million, and that probably increased again in 2018, although we don't have a figure yet. So consumption has risen notably in the U.S. This is still a relatively marginal drug, especially if you compare it to alcohol. Mm-hmm. But if you compare it to tobacco, let's say, it is catching up. And among the young, young people are actually more likely to use cannabis than tobacco.
You mentioned that you and a New York University professor analyzed overdose and drug use data. And I wanted to know, what did that tell you about the connection between marijuana use and opiate deaths? Because this is one of the things that comes up all of the time. Look, marijuana may have its challenges, but as an alternative to, you know, the growing number of opiate deaths going on out there, it should be an option. What do you say to that?
So this is one of the things that really frustrates me. So the evidence for this theory comes from a paper that was published in JAMA Internal Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, Internal Medicine, in 2014. That paper drew on data that only went to 2009. And it said, well, when we look at this state-level data, some states that legalize medical marijuana appeared to have lower opioid overdose deaths. Okay, this is an incredibly weak finding even at the time. There's several reasons for that. I go into it in detail in the book, and honestly, we could spend the next 20 minutes talking about it. But let me just give you two very quickly. One is that looking at state level data in general is not a good way to tease out inference, okay? Because there's lots of different things that can happen at the state level. One state might put in a prescription drug monitoring program. One state might encourage its police chiefs to deliver naloxone to people. There's lots of different reasons that have nothing to do with cannabis why drug overdose deaths would fall or rise, okay? Two, if you just look at a map, the states that legalized cannabis for medical use at first were almost all west of the Mississippi, Colorado, California, Washington, Oregon. The opioid epidemic started in Appalachia. Okay, those two things had nothing to do with each other. Now, since 2009, we have a national opioid crisis. We have national medical marijuana, basically. And guess what? If this finding were real, if it weren't some statistical artifact or some geographic artifact, it would have gotten stronger in the last few years. Instead, it has gone away. There is no evidence linking medical marijuana laws to state overdose deaths either way. More importantly, if you want to find out what people are doing on an individual basis, the best way to track them is to track individuals, not states, individuals. So guess what? When you look, and there's a very good paper that came out in JAMA Psychiatry the beginning of 2018 on this issue, it showed that people who used cannabis 3 years later were 3 to 4 times as likely to use opioids. And if they were using cannabis in a problematic way, if they had what's called cannabis use disorder, they were about 3 times as likely to have an opioid use disorder 3 years later. That is good, hard epidemiologic data. It does not prove that cannabis causes opioid use, but it certainly is stronger than anything pointing the other way on the state level.
But why would that be? Why wouldn't it be if you can find what you think might be a safer way to get just high and, you know, self-medicate yourself? Why wouldn't that diminish the numbers of opioid uses?
So there's sort of three questions in one there. One, you said get high. Okay. Addicts tend to like to get high in all kinds of different ways. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence that that once people find out they like getting high with one drug, they're happy to try other drugs.
So it's a presumption to say they just pick one. It's like
I'm sure you know people who use drugs, and you know most people. Yes, they may have a drug they favor, but you know once you start using drugs, you tend to use anything that's presented to you. I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, sure. but there's truth in that. The second you said self-medicating. The self-medicating theory really is more to do with mental illness. So let's just set that aside for a minute.
Okay.
But let's say you're using opioids because you really need them. You have terrible cancer pain. You have, chronic lower back pain that is, you know, you've got blown discs that are visible and they want to operate on you. I mean, this is not you malingering. This is you with severe chronic pain of some kind. And you find relief from opioids in that pain. Okay. And you say, I want to use cannabis instead. Unfortunately, cannabis is actually not a very good analgesic. Okay. It's an intoxicant, but it's not a very good analgesic. There's only been one study I've ever found that compared a cannabinoid to an opioid. It was done, I believe, in Britain about 10 to 12 years ago. And it showed that the opioid, which is actually a weak opioid called dihydrocodeine, which is not, it's not codeine. It's a variant. It's not used in the U.S., had significantly stronger pain relief than this synthetic cannabinoid.
Well, you call it marijuana. You say it's a mild pain reliever at best.
It's a mild pain reliever. It's like alcohol. If there's nothing else around, you know, if you're in Tombstone, Arizona in 1860 and the doc has to pull the bullet out of your arm, he's going to give you some whiskey and hope it works. But it is not a very effective pain reliever. More proof on this comes from the fact that there's a company called GW Pharma that studied, which is it's a reputable pharmaceutical company based in the UK. It's a cannabinoid pharmaceutical company. They do real research. They studied for more than 10 years whether they could get approval for a THC/CBD spray for pain relief. Because you can imagine what the market for a non-opioid successful, non-opioid FDA-approved pain reliever would be in this country right now. It would be billions of dollars. I mean, there's almost no limit to what that drug could make. Unfortunately, they have basically dropped their efforts to get that approval because their last three clinical trials of this spray against placebo, not against the drug, but against placebo for cancer pain, showed it didn't work at all. Which is actually surprising to me that it effectively had no effect. Here's my guess on this. Marijuana increases sensation for a lot of people, and that may not actually be something that you want when you're in pain. You know, if you're having sex or, you know, you're listening to music you really like, you may be happy to have increased sensation, at the sort of cellular level in the brain. But when the sensation is pain, enhancing that may not actually be a good thing.
Alex Berenson, his book is Tell Your Children, The Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER's mobile app gives you everything you love about our station on the go. Stream KUER live on your phone, listen to NPR and local stories on demand. Then shift gears and listen to our 24/7 classical music station or explore podcasts like Radio West and 45 Days. It's all on the KUER app. Download it for free for Android or iOS, wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Alex Berenson is joining us to make his case against marijuana. Marijuana, he says, is not medicine, and it's not the panacea some think it is. His most serious charge is that cannabis can aggravate or cause psychosis and lead to violence. His book is Tell Your Children, The Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. Berenson joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. Okay, Alex, let's get to the central issue you deal with in the book, and that's this connection between cannabis use and mental illness. And you say early in the book that on some level it's strange how obvious this link has been and for how long.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that if you go back to the 1880s and 90s, when there were what were called at the time insane asylums in Britain, or I'm sorry, in India, that were run by British doctors, and had mostly Indian patients, these doctors noted how many of their patients and their patients' families blamed what was generally called ganja, mm-hmm. Relatively high potency cannabis, although not nearly as strong as what we use today, for their mental illness. And there were asylum records on this.
It's interesting. You mentioned a Chinese reference guide from like the 1200s or the 1500s.
Think it's about 2,000 years ago. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so for centuries and centuries, physicians have been worried about the potential for violence in marijuana?
Well, it's more so the first effect is mental illness, right? Generally what we call today as psychosis. The British tended to call it mania. Hmm. The nomenclature around mental illness has developed in the last, it's developed in the last century. Schizophrenia, as a term, didn't really exist until about 1908. But so people see mental illness, in India, they would also see crime that was associated with this mental illness.
We need to get to what's become a critique about the book itself. And you mentioned the organization, the Drug Policy Alliance. So let me quote them here. What they've said is that you are irresponsibly and dangerously claiming a causal link between marijuana use and increases in rates of psychosis and schizophrenia. And what they talk about is that, yes, there may be some associations, and you have stories and you have anecdotes in the book, but because these connections, as they put it, are so complex and so mediated by other kinds of factors, that it's just not responsible of you to draw any of the conclusions that you're actually drawing. But you're really emphatic in the book. In fact, you say the debate is over. By any reasonable standard, you say that connection has been proven. That's the word you put.
Sure.
So respond to that.
Well, I mean, the DPA is right. I am saying that. I'm not saying it irresponsibly, though. You've read my book, so you know that the entire middle of the book is not anecdote. It's about the scientists who've spent the last generation teasing out correlation and causation. And you know, people love to say to me, correlation is not causation, as if I didn't consider that in writing the book, and as if the people who've been working really hard on this for 30 years haven't been considering that. So, you know, the truth is we have never actually had, if you want to say something causes something, mm-hmm. you know, on a scientific level, forget on sort of an a metaphysical truth-telling level, but if you say X causes Y, you say that because of a randomized controlled trial where you take two groups of people who are supposed to be basically identically matched, you give one of them one treatment, and you give the other group another treatment, which could be a placebo. And then you say, we're going to follow you for 6 months or a year or 2 years, and we're going to see what the active treatment does and what the placebo does. Mm-hmm. And if there's a change between those two groups, you say, well, okay, we think to the extent that human beings can know anything, that the treatment caused the change. That's why if you go to the doctor and you say, you know, you're a cardiologist and you say, doc, you know, I'm having chest pains or whatever, and he takes your cholesterol level or she takes your cholesterol level and it's high, you get a statin. Because there are dozens of randomized controlled trials that show that statins reduce cholesterol and reduce heart attacks and other cardiovascular events. That's why we say statins do that. But here's the problem with trying to do that for a drug that we think is harmful. Mm. You cannot ethically expose people to harm. Beyond the fact that I don't know how you would, as a practical matter, tell 10,000 people to smoke marijuana every day and 10,000 not to, and you'd trust them to do it. Forget the practicalities. Ethically, it's not allowed. It's impossible. So,
but that's one of the critiques for your book, is that you cannot randomize these studies.
Well, okay, but you cannot randomize studies to show that tobacco causes lung cancer either. But we say tobacco causes lung cancer, and it does. Why? Because in the absence of randomized controlled trials, you depend on other factors. You depend on epidemiologic studies. You look for a dose-response relationship, which there is in this case, in the case of cannabis and psychosis. You challenge and de-challenge vulnerable people. In other words, people who have schizophrenia, whose psychosis is well-controlled, will become uncontrolled and have florid psychotic episodes after use. You look for plausible brain mechanisms. You look and say, well, is there, if you give some people something that's even stronger, are they even more likely to develop psychosis? In the case of the synthetic cannabinoids, K2 and Spice. And yes, we see psychosis developing very quickly in many users with those. You say, are the studies done over a period of time from many researchers and relatively free of corporate bias or anything like that? Yes, yes, yes. So at some point you have to say, okay, we have not proven this yet. Oh, and by the way, is there a genetic underpinning we can find? And the answer to that question is basically no. There's some weak evidence that people who have genes for risk taking tend to use cannabis and other drugs, which might sort of confound the development of schizophrenia. But basically, no. Oh, and one more, by the way, you try to separate out confounding factors. So confounding factors are, do we have a family history of schizophrenia? Do we have other drug use? Are there other, you know, known stresses that can cause the development of schizophrenia? Scientists have done all those things. And I go into those studies in some detail in my book. Right. And it is very frustrating for me when people say, well, correlation does not prove causation. Didn't anybody tell you that?
But aren't you saying that the association is enough? It seems like we had a conversation with Gary Taubes a while back, who's making this case against sugar and making this case about the carbohydrates, for example.
Sure.
But there isn't enough yet. There aren't enough studies for him to make this causal link, to make a direct link. So what he's saying is, if this were a legal trial and I was talking to a jury, you readers are a jury, I have reasonable proof. I can't exactly make the direct cause here, but I have enough for there to be a reasonable proof? And are you saying the same thing in some ways, that there's enough here? The association is enough for there to be risk and concern?
Well, I'm saying that that's an absolute minimum. I mean, so if tobacco is 99.99% proven, okay, proven as well as it can be in the absence of a randomized controlled trial, and the sugar hypothesis, which I don't really know, but I'll take your word for it. Let's say that's been proven to a civil trial standard, a preponderance of the evidence.
Right.
What I'm saying is this is a lot closer to tobacco than to sugar. Okay, this is approaching criminal trial standard, which, depending on who you, that could be 98%, it could be 95%. We are certainly at the point with cannabis and psychosis, with cannabis and mental illness, with cannabis and, general psychiatric harm, that we need to warn people about this. We do not need to wait 30 years and have, untold misery as a result.
Maybe you've already done it, but respond to the contention that you're just cherry picking the data. There was there's a health services research blog, the Incidental Economist, that mentioned what we were talking about before, that you can't randomize these studies, so it's difficult. And here's a quote here I want you to respond to.
Sure.
Even if we did a large-scale randomized study of 10,000 participants with high compliance costing millions of dollars, we could never know anything about murder and weed. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, yeah, 10,000 people, because murder is relatively
rare.
Is relatively rare in our society, fortunately. So we have to look at other evidence. The best evidence for the cannabis violence theory, beyond the fact that there is some direct data, there's some studies both of people with psychiatric illnesses and sort of the general population showing that users are more likely to commit various kinds of violence. The best evidence is this. We know, and again, when I say no, this is not really open to dispute. It's a very large clinical or very large epidemiologic study showing this, that psychosis is a major risk factor for violence. Okay. By the way, everyone knows this intuitively too, which is why when I'm on the subway platform in New York City and there's a person next to me who's talking to himself and, looks disheveled and sort of floridly psychotic, if the train is coming in, I walk to the other end of the platform. Not because I know he's going to do something to me, but because I know the risk is higher than the little old lady who's sitting there with her nose in a book. Mm. And so we know this intuitively. So a substance that produces a lot of psychosis, to me, there's reason to believe intuitively that it's going to drive violence. But my book is not about intuition. It's about the work that has already been done on this topic.
How do you explain, Alex, the relationship between cannabis and psychosis and ultimately violence? I mean, what is the cannabis doing? Is there a certain buildup going on? What's the kind of technical aspect of this that you understand it?
So the best answer to that is we don't really know.
Yeah.
But the reason for that isn't that we don't know what receptors cannabis hits in the brain. We know it, predominantly affects this sort of, and it's called the endocannabinoid system, the CB1 receptors. We know those receptors can produce dopamine release, and dopamine release has been linked to, psychosis as well. The real reason we don't know why cannabis causes psychosis or what psychosis exactly looks like, cannabis-driven psychosis in the brain, is we don't really know what psychosis looks like in the brain. I mean, that is to say, there's been a tremendous amount of research on this topic, and you can sort of find some abnormalities in the brain, but you can't actually diagnose psychosis based on a brain scan. It's totally a clinical diagnosis. So despite the very serious efforts and tremendous amount of money that's been spent on this and the dedication of the researchers, brain science is really a black hole in many ways. And you can see that in the development of antipsychotic medicines, which effectively really are all based on the same drugs from the 1950s.
You say in the book that when you started writing it, people would always end up asking you whether you thought marijuana should be legal. And you talk about how for a while you dodged the question, but you come right out, as you mentioned earlier, and say where you come down. Decriminalization, you say, is a good compromise. Legalization goes too far for you.
Yeah, because you wind up with this industry that's going to promote use. And you can avoid most of the public policy problems with decriminalization. And I think you know, I think unfortunately right now where the U.S. is in some ways it's the worst of all possible worlds, where we have this patchwork and it's, you know, it's being it's driven by lobbying. And, you know, in some cases now we have some negative spillover effects where, you know, some states that are legal are next to states that are not legal. And so there's naturally going to be trafficking going on. And we have this advocacy groups pretending that this is medicine when it's not. Honestly, if you said to me all 50 states were going to have loose medical, what's called loose medical, where you can basically get cannabis for any claimed medical condition, or full recreational legalization, I would say let's go with full recreational legalization, because at least we're dropping the fiction that this is medicine. We're talking about this as a recreational intoxicant, which is what it is. But more important, and I truly believe this, more important than the legal status of this drug is that we inform people, especially young people, about the risks, that we do the same kind of fact-based, science-based discouraging of use that we do for tobacco. We have been very, very successful at curbing tobacco and cigarette use among the young, this mini epidemic of Juul notwithstanding in the last 20 years, we've been very successful. In the last couple of years, Juul has messed things up a little bit. But we can do the same thing for cannabis. And by the way, it's up to the media to start telling the truth about the drug. And it would be nice if Hollywood, you know, stopped glamorizing your local, pot dealer riding his bike around Bushwick, delivering to pregnant women, as in the HBO show High Maintenance. So we can go a long way to discouraging people from using this drug, whatever its legal status is. And to me, that's a lot more important.
You say writing the book at times was kind of a depressing exercise, but, you say when you got two down, you were reminded yourself that we sort of were in this situation before, something like it in the late 1970s, and that seemed to give you a sense of hope.
So in the 70s, there was a movement to decriminalize. There was a lot of cannabis use, and it very rapidly went bad because cannabis use was became linked in the public mind to cocaine use. Cocaine was sort of, you know, a rising scourge at that time. What's very interesting is that I think because the cannabis lobby has done such a good job with this fake idea that that cannabis is an off-ramp for opioids, although the United States has an incredible scourge of opiate use right now, of opioid use, and Canada does too. We're the two countries with the worst problem with opioid use, and we also have the worst, the highest levels of cannabis use. Somehow, nobody's managed to make the connection that maybe those two things are related, and that actually cannabis use is not a good idea for in terms of discouraging people from using opioids. But I believe, you know, that people are opening their eyes to the problem. Some people said, well, it's the book that's doing it. I don't think the book is very nice, you know, and I'm glad it's generated some debate. It hasn't sold enough copies to galvanize millions of people or anything like that. What I do think it's done is that there's some people out there who've lived through problems with cannabis or have seen their children have problems with cannabis. And those people have been gaslit by a whole culture. A whole culture has told them that this is a good drug, that there's no real harms with it, that you're just basically a loser if you have any problems with it. And some of those people now have said to me, they said it to me, like, your book gave me confidence that what I saw in my own life was real. And, you know, for that reason alone, I'm glad I wrote it.
Let me ask you this finally. Do you see, right now, it seems like you have two extremes. One that suggests it's benign and harmless. Another that says it's going to be a disaster. I know where you come down sort of on that, but do you think there's any way, any accommodation we can make as a culture or society to find some place in the middle, do you think, at this point?
Well, I think what we can do is acknowledge that people are going to use it and discourage them from using it. And educate, you know, kids and their parents and law enforcement officers and ER docs and people who are going to, you know, have to clean up the wreckage as to here's ways we can reduce the harm around this a little bit. Obviously, there are going to be people who use this drug no matter what. I don't think we need to legalize. I don't think we need a big industry promoting its use. And I think the media should be a lot more savvy. All these people, all these reporters who write these wonderful stories about cannabis, where have they been for the last, you know, 50 years with tobacco and 20 years with opioids? I don't understand why they think that the people who stand to benefit from greater use of an addictive drug are going to tell them the problems with the drug. So I think if we combine sort of reasonable media skepticism, you know, some public education, and not allowing a big industry to spring up here, we can try to mitigate the harms. And again, look, you can go into any casino in Las Vegas and see people who've lost their houses, right? You can go into any oncology ward and see people who've gotten lung cancer from smoking. We are a free society. We tolerate some harms from, you know, personal use or personal decisions people make. But we have to educate people about the risks.
Alex Berenson, his book is Tell Your Children, The Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. He joined us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.